This is a podcast from thebuglepodcast.com.
The Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to Bugle 293 sub-episode FIFA, in which we take a look back at some of the great Bugle moments in blatterism and football. I am Andy Zaltzman, reporting inclusively for the Bugle from a shed in South London, and not joining me this week is John Oliver, already being tipped as the man to make jokes about whoever takes over from Sepp Blatter as the new Sepp Blatter. This week, Uncle Sepp, the self-styled Sepp Blatter of football, finally announced his future resignation as undisputable Genghis Khan of the world's favourite game. Did he jump? Was he pushed? Can he fly? Who paid for his jetpack? And could he simply be the unluckiest administrator ever not to notice an absolute Krakatoa of corruption building up and rumbling volcanically underneath his entirely innocent throne? Well, all those questions can wait. For now, let's look back at the happy time before FIFA had entirely innocently decided to award a World Cup to a place which scientists have confirmed is the second least appropriate place for a football World Cup after Antarctica. This was back in Bugle 135. Sport now, and well, in the next week, FIFA will decide who hosts the 2018 and 2022 World Cups. England in the running for 2018, and your country, John, the USA, in the running for 2022. Is America excited about this, or has no one noticed?
Number one, baby.
I still think most of America hasn't noticed they actually hosted it in 1994 yet.
So, no, it's a kind of hazy memory.
But here in England, we are getting very excited that we might get to host the World Cup. We're up against a number of other contenders. I'll do quick pros and cons of each contender. Belgium and the Netherlands. Pros. None. Cons. Involved Belgium. Historically unable to prevent German victory. Could unleash a new wave of stand-up routines about smoking weed in Amsterdam, with a twist being, what if the world's top footballer smoked weed in Amsterdam before playing the World Cup? What would that be like? Must be stopped.
Oh, strong, Andy. Strong premise.
Russia, pros, might get to see Vladimir Putin fully nude riding a wildebeest at the opening ceremony. Cons, probably a front for taking over Eastern Europe again. Portugal and Spain, pros, none. Cons, could push up the price of Iberico ham. England, pros, greatest nation in the history of the universe, invented football and everything else worth doing in the world, like cricket, snoozing and imperial conquests. Nicest people in the known world, don't speak their own cliquey, clubby language, they speak the language of the world, English. Also, this nation will still be basking in the afterglow of next year's royal wedding. We also keep saving the world from the threat of extremist totalitarian regimes over and over and over again, and we deserve a kickabout in recompense. Cons, would be so awesome that all subsequent World Cups would seem like knitting conventions in a mortuary. So it's hard to see why FIFA, other than in the obvious endemic corruption problem, would not give it to the UK.
You make very good bid, Andy. That's a strong bid.
Yep. America is up against Australia, who don't really like football. Mm-hmm. Qatar, who don't really like football. Japan and South Korea, who don't really like football, and America itself that doesn't really like football. So here's looking forward to 2022. It's going to be a hoot. It's going to be an absolute. Qatar could be the dark horse there. Basically, the country America has always dreamed of being. Some bits of America, anyway. And in their favour, they have absolutely loads of money and an appealingly jaunty attitude to human rights, which may appeal to FIFA president and wannabe world dictator Sepp Blatter, who recently changed.
Well, yeah, I think that's.
He recently changed.
That's the cornerstone of their bid.
He recently changed FIFA's motto from "For the game, for the world" to "It's all about the Benjamins."
I think the entire Qatar bidding packet is just one piece of paper with written in solid gold, "We got loads of money, mate. Seriously, loads."
Over the years, Blatter has not so much blotted his copybook as wazzed all over his copybook, then smeared it in a bath of manure. By the time of Bugle 173, he was back on his crazy and uncontrollably defecating horse, riding it at breakneck speed into the Looney Saloon.
Well, with the world has seen some platinum-grade crackpot leaders departing office this year, as we've seen. But there is one man who is holding fort, and luckily he's not in charge of a country, he's merely in charge of a sporting organisation. That man, of course, is Sepp Blatter.
Yeah.
And this week he added to his impressive portfolio of ludicrous comments by suggesting that if racist insults are exchanged between players on the pitch, they can be settled merely with a handshake at the end of the match.
Oh, dear.
And that will make everything fine.
Yes. And it's football, just like...
football responded with one voice by saying, "Mr. Blatter, you are a turbo dick." He also suggested that genocide is fine as long as it happens on the field of play within the 90 minutes.
We've lost some of, as you mentioned, some of the most eccentric leaders around this year, Andy. Gaddafi, Berlusconi, Bin Laden. But it's easy not to miss any of them when they're all embodied in Sepp Blatter, president of FIFA and professional Pierre Pouard, the executive director of Football Against Racism in Europe, condemned Blatter's comments, saying, "You just don't expect the world leader of football to be coming out with comments that seem ill thought out and insensitive." Yes, you do. This is Sepp Blatter we're talking about. He's been here for years. The man's a f***ing arsehole.
The Professional Footballers Association head, Gordon Taylor, said that Blatter should resign, and he said, "I feel this is the straw that broke the camel's back." Well, John, for years that camel has been lying on the floor, writhing around screaming, "Ow, my back is really sore." In fact, Blatter spent most of his career kicking that camel in its already shattered spine, giggling to himself and thinking of ways to annoy people.
That's right, the camel's looking at us like, "I can't move. I can't feel my hooves."
But I think we in Britain, we should applaud this. The idea that you can settle anything with a handshake, which I believe is pretty much how we wrapped our empire up, was like, "There you go. That's us out of here. All done. Let's shake on it. Right, we are now quits. Good luck. We'll send the tiger skins back in the post. Do pop over any time."
In case you think Candy and I are coming on a little strong here, here's a little highlights package of Sepp Blatter's greatest goals from over the years. In 2004, he suggested that women wear tighter shorts to increase the popularity of women's football. In 2010, Sepp Blatter said that gay fans going to the 2022 World Cup in Qatar, where homosexuality is illegal, should refrain from sexual activity. And when John Terry was stripped of the England captaincy in 2010 following an alleged affair, Blatter suggested that he would be applauded in Latin countries. F*** you, Sepp Blatter. F*** you.
After awarding the 2022 World Cup to Qatar on the grounds that A, he'd always wanted to see what happens if you make elite athletes run around in 50-degree heat for 2 hours, and B, he wanted to see the looks on people's faces when he read the words out, "The winner is Qatar," without following up with the words, "Ah, got ya." He made this comment where he advised homosexuals to simply refrain from being so goddamn homosexual during the tournament.
Right.
This man, there's nothing that he will not turn his hand to, John. Or isn't there? Because aside, you mentioned the women. He'd also described the way footballers are transferred between clubs as modern slavery. And this was whilst talking about Cristiano Ronaldo, who's transferred for $80 million and paid around about £250,000 a week, which even with 200 years of inflation, I think is a little bit more than the average plantation worker got. I guess they didn't have quite such pushy agents bumping up their transfer fee and wage packets, though. But there's one group that he has not turned his fire on, John. He's insulted blacks, women's, gays. And I know what you're all thinking here, buglers. Why has Sepp Blatter laid off the Jews? What have my people done wrong to escape this imbecile scattergun shitheadery?
Yeah.
And the answer is, John, he has delegated, because the president of the Argentinian Football Association, one of Blatter's key allies, sod it, let's call him a henchman. why not? Can you actually have a henchman if you are nice or not? Do you have to...
Yeah.
I
don't know. Do you not have to be a bit of a dick to get a henchman?
No, Andy. That's a very offensive generalisation.
Really? I thought if you're nice, a henchman is just a secretary. But
oh, God, Andy, right? you're going to have the henchman's union coming down on you like a ton of bricks.
Anyway, his henchman, the Argentinian FA president Julio Grondona, who has been variously described as an embarrassment to his entire continent. That is a big area to embarrass simultaneously. Also likes to be known as the Godfather, which is not usually the sign of someone with an appropriate level of self-awareness and modesty. But anyway, Grondona said, "I do not believe a Jew can ever be a referee at the highest level. It's hard work, and you know, Jews don't like hard work."
Oh my God!
So there you go. And this was 8 years ago, John. What is this man doing now? He is still in FIFA in one of the top positions alongside Sepp Blatter. I guess we should just be thankful, John, that Grondona and Blatter are mercifully restricted to the relatively safe area of sports admin.
Yes.
Because in the same way that a couple of different turns early in life could have turned Colonel Gaddafi into a circus entertainer instead of a brutal despot, if Blatter had taken the other fork in the road, he could so easily have ended up sitting in the dock in The Hague watching the tide roll on its court, refusing to recognise the legitimacy of the court. Every time I hear the latest verbal atrocity Blatter has committed, I think to myself, this is a great day for humanity. This could have been so much worse.
Andy, Sepp Blatter has giant, giant brass balls flanking what has to be a tiny penis.
You might think that giving the World Cup to Qatar is a bit like giving the World Polar Bear Spotting Championships to Mexico. They might just about pull it off, but traditional fans are not really going to enjoy it. And whilst you might think that Blatter has made FIFA look like an organisation more out of touch than a dead hermit in a disused nuclear bunker, let's look on the positive side. Most recent World Cups have been held in countries where homosexuality is legal, so it's good to spread it around. Anyway, enough of all this. Time for some football. Actual football. The 2010 World Cup was in many ways the first football World Cup to be covered on the Bugle. And this was how we looked ahead to what proved to be a bit of a damp squib of a tournament. A damp, monotonously noisy, idiotically unusable, ball-afflicted, shit squib of a tournament.
Top story this week, England versus the USA! Oh, it's on, Andy! It's on like Donkey Kong! The old rivals, the student and the teacher, the father figure and the rebellious son, the old world versus the new world, good versus pure evil. What a game!
The priest against the chorister.
What a game. Tomorrow, June the 12th, we'll finally decide who is the better nation between the two, who has the better citizens, and who will become the legal territory of who for the next 4 years. There's a nice little subtext to it, adding a little spice. And many thanks to David Cameron and Obama for just injecting that extra amount there. It's the only way Americans are going to care about this game, man. It's the only way.
Do they not care, John? I mean, how big is the World Cup stateside?
Well, I think they're going to care until the US get knocked out. And I think they're definitely going to care for the England-USA game. It's on ABC, it's on network television as well as ESPN here. And I think it's going to be a big deal. You know, we've done our part on the Daily Show. My boss is a huge football fan. And, you know, we've been trying to really get people involved. I don't know if Daily Show viewers are natural soccer fans.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're trying our best. We've even recorded three possible chats for next Monday, because I won't be there. I'll still be in South Africa, based on the three results. And I've got to say that even when doing them, I was getting really excited during the win. I was absolutely devastated after. I'm not an actor, Andy.
But well,
and in many ways, neither is
your
my
Wikipedia
boss.
Entry will dispute that.
I don't think either me or John Stewart are particularly great actors. And yet, look, we were both very easily able to channel very deep, profound emotions necessary. Just shows how deep this runs. For me, Andy, I guess this is the thing. The stakes simply could not be higher. If England lose, I just don't see how I'm going to be able to go back to my office. It would be hell. My boss will make my life a living misery. The entire studio crew will be waiting to start a period of round-the-clock laughter into my face for the next 6 months. They've organised it. They're going to be sleeping in shifts to ensure no break or interruption. Because of the Daily Show, I've done the worst possible thing and spent a couple of days at the US training camp talking to the players, many of whom now I really genuinely like.
Right.
Jonathan Spector is an incredibly nice guy.
I see you've made a real mistake, mate.
It's terrible. Stuart Holden's also great. And, you know, everyone I spoke to was friendly, with no ego, more than willing to put up with my shit.
Yeah, and that's what they want you to think, John.
I know.
That's how they weaken you in a war.
Oh, that's... This is exactly what I need to hear, Andy.
It's classic wartime tactics, John.
This is not, because it does. I just feel like it's taken a bit of edge away from the game for me. It's taken a bit of my edge away. Now, of course, that should all disappear when I'm in Rustenburg. That's what I'm hoping.
Yeah.
Now, when I'm there and I'm thinking about the personal consequences I will suffer should England lose, I need to psych myself up for it.
Yeah. Well, that's the key when you're watching a game like that. You've got to be 110% mentally ready to watch it.
I mean, I don't want to get carried away here, Andy, let's make sure we keep this in perspective. It's sport. But, you know, were England to win this game, it would be a fitting answer to both the Boston Tea Party and the War of Independence.
That's
no
right.
more, but certainly no less.
Now time for the first in the Bugle Classic World Cup commentaries. And the BBC have very generously let us delve into their archives. And this one comes from the 1954 World Cup final between Germany and Hungary. And here we hear BBC commentator Drolston Crandling.
It's Germany 2, Hungary 2, with 6 minutes remaining. Here come the Germans. The ball falls to Rahm. He shoots. Oh, it's gone in! Shit it! The f***ing Crabs are going to win the World f***ing Cup! Ball sacks, I lost half a f***ing leg in the war thanks to these guys! How much are these cheating f***ers paying the ref? Well, if there's ever been a more obvious miscarriage of justice, I haven't f***ing seen it. Shit bad McGonagalls, I'm out of here.
And this classic commentary comes from 1986. Mexico quarter-final, England against Argentina. Diego Maradona, minutes after punching the ball into the net with one of the most impressive pieces of volleyball ever seen on a football pitch, picked up the ball just inside his own half with the whole of the England team lined up in front of him. Here's ITV's man on the mic at the time, Pernell Hinge.
Maradona gets the ball now, the cheating little shit. What are you going to do? Punch it in from the halfway line, you prick. He turns now. Kick the f***er! Past Beardsley. Whack him, you loser! Past Hodge. What part of kick that bastard of the balls are you struggling to understand, Hodge? Past Reed. Nail him! F***ing nail him! He's up to Fennec now. Come on, Terry, put him in a body bag! F***ing shit, he's past f***ing Butcher as well. F***ing twat him, Terry. Just Shilton to beat now. Take his f***ing head off, Peter. I don't give a f*** if he scores. F***ing ruin him. Oh, bollocks, it's in. Oh, no, it's in. 2-0. Oh, that was a tremendous goal by the little magician. Laurie McMenemy, have you ever seen anything like that?
Oh, my God. I'm crying. Oh, my God.
Is that actually you say you're crying? I remember that's the first time I think I cried at sport when England lost that. I remember I was 11 years old and I wept salt tears when England went out because Lineker missed that f***ing open goal header at the end. She's only still got a career in television. Is that right? Is that right?
Amongst the non-existent highlights of the first week of the 2010 World Cup was the North Korean team, passionately supported as ever by their then still not dead yet leader Kim Jong-il, and the Vuvuzela, the cheap plastic horn that droned out the entire tournament and became globally renowned as the monotonous noise people least wanted to hear, surpassing even the flatlining heart monitor.
Feature section now, World Cup! World Cup, Andy.
World Cup, John.
I mean, our enthusiasm slightly tempered by the fact it's been quite a bad World Cup so far.
It's been the shittest World Cup ever, John. Let's
be honest. Well, come on, first round, Andy.
Yeah, but
keep the faith.
So far, it's been the shittest World Cup ever.
It's not been great.
Yeah,
it's not been great.
It's been bad, John. It's been really bad.
It's
really, really bad. Depressingly bad.
Well, hang in there. Hang in there. First round, Andy. First round, and you know also. There have been some interesting... The North Korean team, I think, it's been very interesting to see them. Of course, Kim Jong-il is a fascinating figure.
Yeah, great and goal he scored.
It was a great... Well,
fantastic goal.
It was fantastically reported, the Brazil-Korea game, by the North Korean news agency. Their match report didn't actually include the score. And this is their exact match report. It said, from the outset of the match, the two teams fought a seesaw battle. Not entirely true. The DPRK footballers created good shooting chances, not losing their confidence even after losing two goals. That's kind of buried in the middle of a sentence. Then it peaks, saying, at about the 88th minute of the match, Jong Tae-sea headed a ball before passing it to Ji Yun-nam, who powerfully kicked it into the rival's goal mouth, scoring a goal. The DPRK team will meet its Portuguese rival on June the 21st. That's it. No mention of the word loss.
No.
No mention of the actual score. But then what do you expect? Because this is one of the greatest news agencies on the planet, Andy. In 2003, again, this is true, they reported that Kim Jong-il had played his first round of golf, finishing the 18 holes at 38 under par, including 11 holes in one that he made, one of which was on a par 5.
Well,
it then calmly ended by referring to him as easily the greatest golfer the world has ever seen. Come on. How do you not love that agency?
I'd just love to have seen his press conference afterwards. Just say, well, just everything ran for me today. But obviously, the thing with golf is, you know, whenever you think you've mastered it, comes back to bite you. So I've just got to get back on the range, come out tomorrow and try and shoot 38 under par again.
There was another great Kim Jong-il story came out during the coach's press, not it was his press conference, it was beforehand. And he said that the dear leader had given him in-depth guidance on how to develop the game in the country, and that the coach also claimed that he received regular tactical advice during matches using mobile phones that are not visible to the naked eye, a technology that Kim Jong-il personally developed. So he's developed invisible phones as well as shooting 38 under par. Also, I don't know what advice that would be other than if you don't win this game, you do know I'm going to kill you.
Right. Maybe he's suggesting
the entire team
going with a controversial formation of 5,000 men marching together whilst looking up at a great big picture of himself. Just put a football at the front of that. You can't go far wrong.
Mm.
Even the Brazilians with their flashy skills. Of course, there have been various reasons why the World Cup has not really lived up to expectations as a footballing tournament. Or what was it like actually being there at the start?
Well, the atmosphere was amazing. And, you know, the atmosphere was great in the stadiums. The transport around it is chaotic at best, and there's an undercurrent of violence. But the actual games themselves were amazing. Were it not for the fact that the whole contest is being ruined by a stupid f***ing ball.
Yeah, well, this is the problem. This new ball called the Jabulani, which is basically brand new for this tournament and had hardly ever been used by anyone around the world before it. It bounces too much, it goes too fast, it doesn't go where players want to when they kick it. It's unpredictable in flight and therefore hard to control, hard to shoot and hard to pass. All of which are problems in a sport which depend on players being able to control, shoot and pass the ball. The complaints have been flooding in. Brazilian striker Robinho said, "For sure, the guy who designed this ball never played football." Denmark's defender Daniel Agger said, "It makes us look like drunken sailors."
Good for you, Agger.
Though, I mean, yes. He does basically look like a drunken sailor anyway. Hey,
but, no, that's not true, Andy. What? He's solid at the back and he's got a thunderbolt of a shot.
Just because he's a Liverpool player doesn't mean you can deny that he looks like a drunken sailor.
No, I'm denying it. Just because he's got tattoos, Andy.
Another Brazilian striker, Luis Fabiano, said, "All of a sudden it changes trajectory on you. It's like it doesn't want to be kicked. I think it's supernatural."
Right, that's the best quote so far.
There is maybe, it is a god. The football is god.
Yeah.
American goalkeeper Marcus Hanneman, although I like to think of him as former temporary Gillingham goalkeeper, Marcus Hanneman. He said, "Technology is not everything." Talking about why this new ball had been developed. "Technology is not everything. Scientists came up with the atom bomb. That doesn't mean we should have invented it." Although,
that's it. Get it in perspective.
To be fair to the scientists who came up with the atom bomb, they came up with it, but then they didn't give the crew of the Enola Gay a special new one for the big day that swerved unpredictably in flight. So why, you may very well ask, are the world's top footballers being asked to adapt to a completely new type of ball?
Ooh, good question.
At the most tournament in the most important tournament in the sport. Now, the obvious answer, of course, John, you might think, is because the people running the sport are obviously quits and charlatans, willing to sacrifice the integrity and success of their showpiece event for the sake of a marketing gimmick, a bunch of unadulterated donkey shits. But you would, of course, be wrong, John, because the correct answer is it's coming. The reason this new ball for a new tournament. The reason is that no previous football, John, had ever worked.
Right.
None of them had worked, John. You know, up until, you know, it's basically, this has been brought in so the game is no longer spoilt by the curse of inadequate footballs that had totally failed to function, that has held the game back for so long. I mean, imagine how much worse this World Cup would have been if they'd had to play with a cubic ball made of lead.
Oh, God, it would have been awful, Andy.
So I think we should stop complaining about...
Yeah, you're right. Now you put it in perspective, it's been a really incredible World Cup so far.
How were the Vuvuzelas when you were there? I mean,
it's loud, definitely, but it's quite fun. Yeah. You know, it contributes to the atmosphere there. I do think the reaction to it has been ridiculous.
Right, because watching on television, I mean, you probably get a different perspective.
Yeah.
It's just blotted out all other sounds usually associated with football matches, such as the crowd and the sense that exciting stuff is happening.
Right.
It seems, the defence of it, that it's part of South African culture. And, you know, why not celebrate such a glorious historic cultural achievement as a mass-produced plastic one-note horn dating back to the 1990s that makes all things sound identical to each other, with a range of artistic impression ranging from honk all the way to honk, it's a goal, honk, it's not a goal, honk, it's nearly a goal, honk, that looked like a penalty, honk, he kicked another player in the plums, honk, Satan himself has appeared on the bench and is starting stretching his hamstrings, I think the Prince of Darkness might be about to come on, honk, the devil just nutmegging Lionel Messi before firing an unstoppable pile driver in from 45 yards and celebrating by eating and regurgitating all his teammates before picking up a second yellow card for taking his shirt off. Is that what football supporters come to?
You just can't read the difference in the inflection, Andy.
It's a soul-sapping, this is really how it was described, a soul-sapping drone, like listening to 20,000 John Kerry impersonators talking simultaneously whilst holding a collection of electric toothbrushes and standing guard over miniature replica stadiums full of mosquitoes amplified to 1,000 times their normal volume. Or like being in an incredibly overcrowded cafeteria surrounded by 100,000 indecisive diners mulling over what dessert to have. It's as if no crowd has turned up, and the stadium organisers have compensated by playing a CD containing highlights of the world's greatest rush hour traffic jams. Also, another problem with the World Cup has been unfeasibly negative tactics by coaches such as former England coach Sven-Goran Eriksson, coaching a very talented Ivory Coast team, who left his best player on the substitute bench for fear that he might score a goal and spoil everything. And it seems that many football coaches and managers clearly feel they've been put on earth with a divine mission to drain the joy from the lives of millions. Your emails now, and, well, we've had a number of emails along these lines. This one comes from Jane, who writes on that subject simply, USA versus England. Dear John and Andy, F*** you and your butterfingers goalie! USA! USA! Yep. USA!
Fair enough.
Lots of love, Jane.
Fair enough, Jane. The point stands.
P.S. Chris, you're doing an awesome job. Keep up the good work.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. Yeah.
I feel after the first half of her email, I find it hard to accept the second part.
Oh, fair enough.
Luckily, at the end of it all, the right team won, Spain, after narrowly overcoming the Dutch kickboxing team in the final. Oh, it brings me no joy to say this, John, but since we last talked on the Bugle, the World Cup's finished.
No, yeah. Andy, I don't believe that is true yet.
Yeah, well, I'm afraid it is true, and finished quite a long time ago now as well, to be honest, it was pretty shit. But at least the right team won, John, Spain.
Yes.
After one of the most dirty football matches of modern vintage, yes. The final with a frankly reprehensible Dutch team. Leading the way for Holland, of course, was the midfielder Mark van Bommel. And yes. As always in the aftermath of big sports events, books get rushed out. And I just bought actually the diary of Mark van Bommel today, and I thought I'd show you one of the entries. Uh-huh. This is from just before the Dutch team flew out to the World Cup.
Great, yeah.
Today I woke up. I excitedly looked in the mirror, but my hopes were swiftly dashed when I was still clearly Mark van Bommel. I kicked my basin, then raked my studs down the side of my bathtub. I then brushed my teeth with my new electronic toothbrush, which I had specially made. It has a little replica football boot on the end, and when you switch it on, the boot repeatedly kicks your teeth and gums until they're clean. Helped me psych up for the day ahead. I went downstairs for breakfast, scything my two-year-old daughter down as I went, before running away before my wife could tell me off. I walked into the kitchen, elbowed the coffee machine right on its cappuccino frother. That had to hurt. Then poured some cornflakes into a bowl. I put the bowl on the floor, then clattered into it from behind, studs raised, shattering the bowl and sending the cornflakes flying all over the kitchen floor. Yum, I said to myself. The perfect breakfast. Darling, I shouted to my wife, I'll just take the dog for a walk. I wouldn't do that, replied my wife a little angrily. He snapped two Achilles tendons and did his knee ligaments after you walked him yesterday. Come on, I hit back. I was going for the ball. Rover hobbled past me, growling, F
you, I muttered at him, surreptitiously treading with my full weight on his bandaged rear left paw. I'm Mark Van Bommel.
Well,
what a read.
Very good read. Very good read.
Still, who cares about the actual football when football politics is so much more exciting? Back in 2011, FIFA held its presidential elections, which I watched on the big screen in Trafalgar Square with 250,000 other admin fans. It was absolutely mental. Blatter was elected unopposed, after which the English FA complained that, quote, a coronation without an opponent provides a flawed mandate. Which was a bit rich coming from Britain. Not only do we have a monarch who is elected by a one-person electorate, consisting of God, but we also have a government which won an election with plenty of opponents and still has an extremely flawed mandate. Now, whilst you might quibble with Qatar being given the World Cup, if, for example, you're human and alive, or with Russia being given the World Cup, if, for example, you're not Vladimir Putin, no one was arguing with Brazil hosting the 2014 tournament, apart from some Brazilians, as discussed in Bugle 240.
Brazilian protesters set their goals! For the last couple of weeks, Andy, tens of thousands of people in Brazil have taken to the streets in protests. At least I think they're protests, Andy. It's a little hard to tell with the Brazilians what the difference is between a protest or a carnival, especially when with them involved, a protest can so easily turn into a carnival anyway when people suddenly start elaborately celebrating how well their protest is going. I think there are clearly some warning signs that can help you define between the two. Are people naked? Probably a carnival. Are they naked because they've had their shirts torn off while being dragged along the ground by police? Probably a protest. Are there people dancing? Probably a carnival. Are there people fighting? Probably a football match. Are there police in riot gear? Probably a protest. Is that riot gear actually body paint? Probably a carnival. Is there tear gas in the air? Probably a protest. Is there glitter in the air? Probably a carnival. Are there water cannons being fired? Shit, that's a grey area. That is a tricky one. It's complicated, Andy. They're complicated people. Even when they're angry, they're joyful.
Well, they do certainly riot with a lot more flair than our rioters, as we saw a couple of summers ago. Very tremendous to watch them.
And it's,
really
it's
fancy
hard to
ones.
Know. Yeah. It's hard to know whether it's, you know, it's born technique or whether it's just the way that you're brought up to express yourself better.
But also you have to ask, you know, with all that flashiness, John, is there enough end product? And I guess, you know, history will be the judge of that.
Well, we'll get to that. But, you know, the Confederations Cup is being played in the Brazil at the moment, all around the country, a tournament which is supposed to be a warm-up for Brazil hosting the World Cup next year and then the Olympics. And Brazil f***ing loves football. Andy, Brazil loves bikinis, football, women with feather wings, football, beach volleyball, football, beach football, and football. Those are the countries. That's right. Those are the country's main areas of interest. But these rallies, protests, riots, and violence are nothing to do with the particular games during the Confederations Cup. They were triggered by a 20-cent rise in public transport fares. And it just goes to show, Andy, everyone has their triggers. Now, it turns out that the Brazilian people will put up with a lot. They'll put up with systemic corruption. They'll put up with poor policing. They'll put up with deforestation and vast wealth gaps. But you do not, I repeat, you do not f*** with their bus fares, Andy. You don't do it.
Well, that's how all revolutions began, just like this one with, it was 20 Brazilian cents, 10 US cents, about 6 pence rise in bus fares. I think that's what got Spartacus so cranky when he went rogue in the ancient Roman days. Might also have been something to do with having been made to fight to the death for the sake of entertainment and everyone having sex all the time in slightly unrealistic ways. I don't know, but it depends how much history was in the TV series. Recent Turkey protests, of course, began with a little tiff about town planning. The American Revolution, as I'm sure our American buglers will know, kicked off because of a misunderstanding about whether you should brew tea in a cup or a pot or a harbour. The Russian Revolution was triggered by Lenin losing Beard of the Year to Rasputin 3 years in a row. That's, you know, just really wound him up.
It was too much. It was too much. Because at that point, now, when you win it 3 years in a row, you keep the beard and he just wouldn't have that.
But Brazil, minor bus fare rise. And that is understandable, I guess, when your bus is basically take about 3 hours to get anywhere and you have no money anyway. So that's, you know, an extra maybe 4 to 6 hours a day in traffic. That is 4 to 6 hours less that you can spend playing football on the beach with an alarming acreage of buttock on show. I mean, that is going to get right to the heart of the issue.
The public transport issue was clearly just the trigger for Brazilians to express other frustrations that have been building up. There are big concerns in Brazil over healthcare, security and rising inflation, and the government overspending on the World Cup and the Olympics has become the focus of this frustration. And you know that if Brazilians are angry about money being spent on the World Cup, there must be a huge problem. Because they would be happy with the government setting fire to a pile of money if they were told that pile of money was a sacrifice for Pelé.
And it was exacerbated, as was the protest in Turkey, by the police reacting to the initial peaceful protests with the restraint and delicacy of a hippopotamus in a lingerie shop. Oh, God, don't try the Basque. Don't try the Basque! Oh, it's not your size. That was inevitable.
The protests have spread across the country and you know, numerous people have died, and the Brazilian media claim the situation is out of control. In the capital, Brasilia, campaigners against social inequality placed 594 footballs in front of Parliament to show that, and I quote, the ball is in the court of the Congress to pass the reforms demanded by those on the streets. See, Andy, Brazilians even deliberate complicated economic issues through footballs, both hypothetically and physically. They love football, Andy. I don't know how much clearer they need to make it. The protests have been the biggest that Brazil has seen in decades and definitely throw into focus the questionable logic of spending billions on sports tournaments when millions of your citizens live in borderline 16th century squalor. But they're already showing signs of success, these protests. President Dilma Rousseff resorted last week to praising the peaceful demonstrations for making democracy stronger. And I wonder how gritted her teeth were when she made that statement, Andy. Did she have an emergency dentist at the side of the podium afterwards to prise her jaw apart? And the results aren't just verbal. They're also practical. In Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro, the proposed transport fare increases have been reversed. The government has also pledged to speed up the broader reforms, and Congress voted to use all the royalties from some newly discovered oil fields for education and health. So again, Andy, see, they even protest like they play football, with flair, technique and impressive results. You can't argue with the results, Andy.
Well, I don't know, John, because when we look back to the last World Cup, Brazil started very strongly in the group stages, and then all looked to be going well, those early results going forward. They couldn't see it through, could they, John? Couldn't see it through. They tanked it against the Dutch in the quarterfinal. So, I mean, will we see this all over again?
I'm just saying, Andy, they've already achieved some very impressive goals!
Of course, allegations of FIFA wrongdoing are not something that are unique to the year 2015. In fact, they've happened in most other four-digit years, AD and BC, including 2014, when FIFA held up a mirror to its own withered, haggard, harrowing face and said, "Man, what a dreamboat. I look like a young Errol Flynn."
FIFA update now. And look, buglers may well be aware of the existence of FIFA, the governing body of global football and a dark stain on the soul of humanity. FIFA are not so much an organisation as they are a misery cartel. Think of them as a private members club for some of the worst people on the planet. And yet again, like corrupt clockwork, they have disgraced themselves. Last Thursday, a report was published that FIFA had ordered, which completely cleared Russia and Qatar of any wrongdoing during the bidding process for the 2018 and 2022 World Cups. What a surprise, Andy, that FIFA's report cleared FIFA and anyone related to FIFA from any wrongdoing. Who could possibly have seen that coming?
It was truly extraordinary. See, FIFA might not be a country, but it does behave like a country, as I think you yourself saw at the last 2010 World Cup, and it behaves like a country whose leaders would love to have regular military parades instead of four yearly football tournaments. FIFA is unquestionably the king shit in the turd bucket of sporting administrative organisations. And one of the things that helped it find itself not guilty of corruption was not publishing the vast majority of the investigation into whether or not it was guilty of corruption. And it just made even more baffling the decision to hold the world's biggest sporting event in a glorified sandpit populated largely by charlatans and slaves. It's just unbelievable that this decision had... No one believes this, John. It is not, that decision could not have been made
properly, honestly, and completely without any suspicious sums of money and or massive coincidental watches changing hands. It just can't have happened.
The crazy thing is, while FIFA, you know, extrapolating a bullshit conclusion from a bullshit report was not in and of itself remotely surprising, the aftermath did end up being quite surprising, because less than 4 hours later, after the report was released, Michael Garcia, the man who had spent 2 years investigating and working on the report, criticised FIFA for mischaracterising what he had written. He apparently delivered a 430-page report in September of this year. However, there was already a beautifully flawed system in place to process that report, because FIFA had chosen to split their ethics committee in two, like a sociopathic Solomon, with an investigation unit headed by Garcia, and then an adjudicatory unit with German judge Hans-Joachim Eckert in charge. So the system was that FIFA would commission an independent report they would own, which would then be adjudicated by a completely independent unit they also own, who would then rewrite it independently. The New York Times has described FIFA this week as exhibiting farcically shady behaviour. And the Wall Street Journal has accused Sepp Blatter of running FIFA like a third world dictator, which is frankly a little insulting, because he really does run FIFA like a first world dictator, Andy. FIFA is a non-profit organisation with over $1 billion in the bank. It creates its own laws and it has a headquarters in Switzerland. It could not be any more farcically shady unless Sepp Blatter sat in a gigantic throne stroking a hairless cat.
As you say, you cannot spell plainly a whitewash without, yeah, what a pile of shite. And it's rebounded on England, who've been one of the main accusers of FIFA, because in the reports they found the English FA guilty of dodgy dealings and some allegedly corrupt activity. And being accused by FIFA of being corrupt is like being approached by a dolphin who comes up and blows cigar smoke in your face and says, "You know your problem, kid? You swim too much." The fact is, top-level football is as dead on the inside as Lucy, the celebrity skeleton of the Australopithecus afarensis species of hominid from 3.2 million years ago, is dead on the outside. In fact, it's fair to say that even now, John, the old girl has a stronger ethical compass than FIFA, in that she has no ethical compass at all, rather than one that points unerringly to dodgy north. And I don't really give a shit about someone stealing Christmas, John, but I do give a shit about someone stealing the World Cup. Now, there are alternatives to Christmas. You have Easter, Hanukkah, Mother's Day, and Ramadan. But the World Cup, John, is the World Cup. Is there nothing sacred anymore?
The biggest surprise in all this has not been the corruption, but finding out that FIFA had an ethics committee, which is a bit like finding out that someone actually wrote a script before they started filming the movie The Last Airbender. You just assumed it hadn't happened. Of course, many are saying this is all classic sour grapes from the British, that we're trampling into a piquant British wine. Well, maybe so. After all, we invented football and now everyone else has overtaken us at it and we're not happy. We also invented bribery and now everyone else has overtaken us at it and we're not happy. Bribery, of course, as British as an abandoned puppy. Battle of Hastings, $20,000 in a brown envelope, King Harold goes down very easily clutching his face. Bingo. Bonjour, Mr. and Mrs. Norman. So there you go, that is all you're getting this week. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Next week we will have either Bugle 294 or Satirist for Hire episode 2-ish, depending on what's going on in showbiz land stateside. I'm recording Satirist for Hire at the Soho Theatre on Monday the 8th of June, also on Monday the 6th of July. If you've gotten any requests for those shows, send them in to satirisethis@satiristforhire.com. Also send us your emails to info@thebuglepodcast.com, and you can find all our Freedom Era episodes on soundcloud.com/the-bugle. Until next time, from me, Andy Zaltzman, stay in school, keep it real, and say no to pickled onions, they are a digestive time bomb. And from me, Andy Zaltzman, PP John Oliver, bye!